Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Imagine, for a moment, that you were just appointed the head of the world's largest religious organization at the outset of the most devastating war ever known to mankind. Further imagine that this war was raging on the continent in which you were headquartered, and that you were living in the capital city of one of the primary belligerents of this war. How would you respond to this situation? How would you respond if you had some knowledge, limited as it may be, that one of the aggressor nations in the war was rounding up individuals based upon their religious affiliation and executing them by the millions? Of course, I am talking about Pope Pius XII, the wartime pontiff who ascended to the throne of St. Peter's in March of 1939, 1 year after Nazi troops marched into Austria, 6 months after Hitler's Germany invaded the Sudetenland, and just days before Hitler invaded the rest of Czechoslovakia. And while the Vatican remained a sovereign entity, there is no doubting that being centered in Rome during Mussolini's fascist regime conditioned how the Catholic hierarchy moved diplomatically. The seeming inaction of Pius XII for the duration of World War II earned him the scorn of many within the Jewish community who viewed him as sitting idly by during the Holocaust, which not only involved the brutal execution of up to 6 million Jews, but also witnessed millions of Polish Catholics put to death, including members of the clergy. Not surprisingly, Pius XII's reign as pontiff drew criticism of Catholics and other Christians as well. However, just a few weeks ago, Yad Vashem, the Israeli Holocaust Museum, reworded its exhibit about Pius XII in the Vatican during the war. The tone of the new exhibit appears more conciliatory than previous versions. As time goes on, and as we uncover more documentation from that era, is the image of the papacy being revised? To answer that question, I am pleased to be joined today by a scholar we had on previously discussing the papacy of John Paul II. That scholar is Dr. James Felak, a professor of history at the University of Washington and author of After Hitler, Before Stalin, Catholics, Communists, and Democrats in Slovakia, 1945 to 1948. He is currently working on a history of Pope John Paul II's visits to Poland while he was pontiff. James, thanks for returning to Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Tony.
Before we dive into the papacy of Pius XII, I have to ask a question I posed to one of our previous guests, John Sweeney, who talked about the short reign of Pope Celestine V, the pope who quit. And this is a question I've always had, and it's perplexed me, and several people have tried to explain it to me time and time again, but I always end up forgetting. Why do popes change their names? And where do they come up with some of these names too? I mean, you have your Bonifaces, you have your Urbans, your Innocents, and of course, your Sisiniuses, who was only one guy, and he lasted all of, I think, 3 weeks in the papacy. So what gives about this naming stuff?
Well, first, I think for a Christian, it should make a lot of sense, because if you look at the Bible, when some big event takes place in someone's life, or they're getting a mission, whether it's, you know, they'll change their name, so, or God will change their name for them. So Abram becomes Abraham, and Jacob becomes Israel, and Saul becomes Paul. So it's a long Christian tradition of when someone takes on an important mission that they may, in fact, also change their names. And particularly for the pope, because Catholics believe the very first pope was St. Peter, and his name was Simon, and Jesus renames him Peter. So the idea of taking on a new name becomes very important. And it's also, you find it elsewhere in the Catholic Church, so when someone becomes a monk or a nun or joins a religious order, they will often take a name. And you pick a name generally of a saint from the past who you have some personal connection with, or you find as an inspiration, And with popes, it also can take on sort of almost a political or theological significance. So just to give an example, Pope John Paul II was named after Pope John Paul I. And Pope John Paul I chose those names because he wanted to connect himself with Pope John the 23rd and Pope Paul VI. Because these were the two popes of the Second Vatican Council, which transformed the Catholic Church in the 20th century. So by taking the name John and Paul, you're connecting yourself with Vatican II in a special way. If a pope were to take the name Pius the 13th, for example, we've had 12 Piuses, that would almost certainly be a conservative statement. That, you know, I want to go back to those popes with conservative reputations like Pius the 12th or Pius the 9th, Pius the 10th. And Pope Benedict, now I'll conclude with him, he chose the name Benedict, and for at least a couple of reasons.
And that's the current pope. You're talking Benedict the 16th,
Benedict
right?
The 16th.
Yep.
Number one, Benedict the 15th was the pope during World War I. It was a very positive figure, big reconciler of tensions in Europe, someone that was that Benedict the 16th could be proud of. And then also Saint Benedict is the patron saint of Europe. And the whole papacy of Benedict the 16th is very much connected with trying to revitalize Christianity in Europe and, you know, reunite Europe on a spiritual level. And so Benedict the Saint Benedict was actually a good saint for that. So there's oftentimes a lot of thinking behind, you know, strategy behind what name a pope's going to choose.
Well, what about the name Innocent? That's always one that is interesting to me, or Pope Urban. Did those names have different connotations way back when they were named? There's a bunch of Innocents, in fact. I think there's almost 15 or 16 of them.
Yeah, you know, these names go back to the early Roman Empire, just the time of antiquity, and sometimes it's because some Roman became a martyr that had that name.
Yeah.
Someone will honor them. Or sometimes it's just a name that means something in the language. Like, okay, Innocent. Like, you know, it either has a kind of a virtue or a pious. You know, you're a pious person. Piety is good, and you name yourself Pious. So the names will kind of catch. And then, you know, once you start to get saints and former popes by those names, then they take on a momentum all their own.
Okay. All right. I just got to ask, do you have any favorite pope names or anything?
Oh, boy. I'll tell you, it's – I always thought if
yeah, if you name, became pope.
Their names, if I make, oh, if I
if you became pope, what would you name yourself?
If you really had a high opinion of yourself, you'd call yourself Peter the Second, because
uh-huh.
No one's dared to do that.
Uh-huh.
Nor is there any Pope Jesus.
Yeah.
There are certain names are off limits. I like the John and Paul connection.
Okay.
They have that there were two early saints named John and Paul who were I think they're like royal bodyguards that became Christian and maybe even were martyred for that. So there's that connection. They pop up in some of the liturgies in the prayers, and then you have, you know, the Pope John Paul bringing the, you know, his predecessors together. So I think that's a pretty.
So you wouldn't do a Pope George or Pope Ringo, would you?
Oh no! You have the Beatles with the John and Paul. I had a friend tell me that. He had Curly Joe of the Three Stooges, you know,
oh, there
Curly
you go.
And a Joe, and then the Curly Joe is honoring his predecessors, yeah. Presumably. So, it's also a very important. Sometimes I'll just pick the name of the church I went to when I was a kid was Saint Paul's, or my uncle's named Boniface, and I like him, or you know, things like this. So there'll be personal connections sometimes,
yeah.
As well.
Oh, cool. Well, all right. Let's get to Pope Pius the 12th here then. And he was born Eugenio Maria Giuseppe Giovanni Pacelli, which, wow, I can understand why he would change that name, because that is a pretty long one. And my Italian's not too good here. So I'm not surprised that you'd want to shorten that. He was a controversial pope for his action, or perhaps we could say lack of action, depending on who you talk to, during World War II. So let me just start out with a heavy question here that I want you to give a brief answer to. Was Pius XII's controversial reputation rightly earned, or should we be engaging in a rethinking of who this pope was and what he did?
Definitely we need to rethink him, and I think definitely he's perceived as more negative than he actually was. And I want to also add that the controversy really doesn't emerge until about 1963. So he wasn't even, you know, at the end of World War II, nobody was saying, gee, Pius wasn't speaking out, Pius wasn't helping the Jews. This really, it took about 20 years for this to build. So that's
I'm wondering if that
significant.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that happens to be a situation of context, that in 1946 or 1947, you look at the Pope and you say, man, we've just been through a lot here in Europe. I kind of understand what that guy was doing. But, you know, after two decades distance from what went on in Europe, then people start saying, yeah, with hindsight, he should have done this or that.
That's I think, a thoughtful analysis. But I think if you really look at the context, during the war, he was actually being praised for speaking out.
Uh-huh.
The New York Times ran a couple editorials praising Pius. Catholic defenders of the Pope like to – they'll reprint these in the Times today as ads now. You know, where he's the lone voice speaking out in Europe against the Nazis. And Jewish groups were thanking him after the war for all he did to help and protect Jews during the war. And so it wasn't really controversial. When he died in 1958, the Israeli foreign minister Golda Meir gave a kind of a eulogy statement praising him for all the help he gave to the Jewish people in their time of distress. And then what happens in early 1963, a German playwright named Rolf Hochhuth writes a play called The Deputy. You know, the idea being, you know, the Pope is thought of as the deputy of Jesus Christ on earth in the Catholic understanding. And it was an attack on Pius as this cold-hearted, cynical manipulator that didn't care about the Jews, didn't want to speak out against the Holocaust. All he cared about was the Catholic Church and its interests, including its material interests. And then this created a huge controversy. There were riots, there were protests in various parts of the world over this, one way or the other. And then you start to get a whole number of scholars and other writers going in to look at this issue. And then they start to, you know, make a big deal out of the fact that, in fact, Pius did not speak out publicly. And let me clarify what the scandal's about. It's that during the entire Second World War, from day one till the end, Pope Pius never came out publicly and condemned Nazis, Hitler. He never mentioned the Jews by name as victims. He never mentioned the Holocaust. He spoke in general terms. He denounced atrocities. He denounced aggression. He denounced people being killed because of their religion and their ethnicity. But he never said, Hitler is killing Jews. So it was this idea that in his public presentations, he did not directly speak about these issues. Privately, he's lobbying governments. He's trying to apply diplomatic pressure to get Jews protected from deportation to death camps and so on. But publicly, he's not making a statement. So if you're a critic of Pius, you say, if only the Pope had spoken out, then, you know, people would have either been warned the Holocaust was happening, or it could have. Maybe even got Hitler to back off, or created, you know, greater pressure. So that's where the criticism is really coming from. He's publicly silent in the sense that he's not speaking out using specifics, only generalities.
Okay. Well, I want to come back to what he did in the wartime era, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in detail. But whenever you deal with a historical figure, it's always important to set this person's life in its proper context. So let's go ahead and go back to the beginning of Pius XII's life, and I will refer to him as Pius XII, even in his pre-pontiff days. He had that really long Eugenio Maria Giuseppe name.
You could call him Gino.
Gino, was that his nickname? No, okay, well, we'll call him Gino here in the early 21st century. Okay. So tell us a little bit about his early childhood and his adult years. His early adult years. Was he raised in a devout Catholic home?
A devout Catholic home with a long tradition of working for the Vatican, with, you know, lots of uncles and relatives that are church leaders at various levels, about as Catholic an upbringing as you could get. From the time he knew what a priest was, he wanted to be a priest.
Okay. So he had this design on entering the priesthood, had a lot of uncles. I guess being in Rome, or he was born around Rome or in Italy.
He's from a lot of – most Italian popes weren't from Rome. So he was the first pope from Rome in a few centuries, I believe. But he was – yeah, so grew up in Rome in this Roman Catholic milieu.
Okay. So he's got that he's got people on the inside, and he sees the workings, and he says, okay, so this is my life for me. It sounds like he decided early on. What was his kind of training? Did he, you know, age 16 says, hey, I'm off to the seminary? Or yeah, even...
They trained you, you know, from the time, you know, probably middle school at least.
Wow.
You're in a kind of a preparatory – school, and he was training, getting the theology and the philosophy, and his more professional training was in law, you know, church law, civil law, and also diplomacy. Particularly as he started to make his career, he went up the diplomatic ladder and got some really important assignments.
Okay, so tell me about that, because this is one of the things I'm fascinated about, how people rise in the ranks of different institutional hierarchies, including the Catholic Church, but a lot of other churches and other institutions as well. I think about, you know, University of Washington. How does somebody get to become provost or president or something? Do they have designs early on this, or is it just something that somebody, a mentor, plucks you out and says, hey, you got these skills and we want you to pursue this path? So what was kind of going on with Gino here? Did he want to just be a parish priest, or did he from the outset said, no, I'm looking up toward St. Peter's Basilica and going there someday?
Yeah, I think he's – well, I don't – he thinks he's going to be Pope, but I definitely – he wants that kind of fast-track Vatican career.
Okay.
And, you know, again, he's growing up in all of this. He has role models all around him, and he was very, very smart. And you know, if you're smart and you have these skills, the church will oftentimes, you know, connect you with the track that you're supposed to be on. So they select certain, you know, you're getting all of these kids coming into these seminaries, and the cream's going to kind of rise to the top intellectually, and then those guys will get kind of furthered along with more specific training, like, you know, we're going to make you a canon lawyer, we're going to, you know, train you in papal diplomacy, and those are the avenues that Pacelli goes down at that time in his life.
So you said that Pacelli had an interest early on in canon law or church law. Is there a difference between canon law and church law?
It's canon law. So
okay, canon law. And that. Diplomacy. I mean, what do we mean by church diplomacy? Is that within the church or external relations to other faiths and nations, like being a papal nuncio or something?
Yeah, the church has relations. You know, the Vatican City as a separate country hadn't existed yet, because you remember when Italy got unified, the Pope's land was taken away from him. He was, as he said, a prisoner in the Vatican. So, but you know, the Vatican still maintains some sort of relation with countries because you have Catholic churches in most countries. So there's still going to be, you know, a lot of church, for example, in France that the Vatican will have an interest in. So there's going to be negotiations with governments, when there's going to be, you know, when the French are going to pass education laws that are attacking public schools, the Vatican wants to be able to go to the government of France and defend the schools. And so there's you know, we have relations with just tons of ways the Catholic Church crosses with political systems. So, for example, your country is going to fight a war and they draft the citizens, young men, into the army. Well, are they going to draft priests? Are they going to draft seminarians? Or are those guys going to get an exemption? That all has to be worked out on a legal basis with the Vatican. So these kinds of things. You know, how does the Vatican first manage relate to other churches, other Catholic churches around the world? And then how does it relate to the governments in which those churches have to operate? So these are the kind of things Pacelli was learning as he was. And he got great position. He got sent to Munich during the tail end of World War I. So he was the papal nuncio. That's like the chief ambassador to Munich. Then he stayed on and became the papal nuncio to Germany. So he was the basically ambassador of the Vatican to Weimar, Germany. And then in 1930, after a decade of doing that, he gets promoted to Secretary of State, which is the guy in charge of all the Vatican diplomacy. And by that time, the Vatican now has Vatican City, and it's an actual country, too. So he's right at the heart. For 20 years, he has major positions in Vatican diplomacy.
So I am thinking not only that diplomatic experience is going to become important in choosing him at the Pope at this critical point in time in 1939, but probably his experience in Germany as well.
Oh, yeah. And they, you know, Benedict XV got elected Pope in September of 1914 because he was diplomatically astute. And they said, you know, Europe is just – World War I just broke out a month ago, and we need a Pope that can navigate the church through this. And when we got to 39, World War II hadn't broken out yet, but it was clear there was a lot going on in Europe with Munich Agreement and an attack on Czechoslovakia by Hitler and threats to Poland, and Mussolini was throwing his weight around and on and on and on. And so it was very it was pretty clear that he was going to become the Pope, that Pacelli was the guy that was already – he had a huge influence in the Vatican. Pius XI was, in a sense, grooming him to be the next Pope. That doesn't always work. But in this case, it did. And a lot of it, I think, had to do with the fact that Pacelli understood diplomacy. He had a he understood Germany, and was the right man for the time.
I'm wondering also to what extent the situation in Italy had any play on this, because let's see, Mussolini comes to power in what was it, about 32?
I think no, like 22.
I think. And so that's really changing things quite a bit in Italy. Could that play a factor here? And as an aside question too, and maybe you can address this. It seems that Italian popes have all, or Italians have always had a leg up on becoming popes. I mean, if you take a look at the last couple centuries, the vast majority of popes have been from Italy.
There has not been a non-Italian pope since about the 1520s.
Okay.
Martin Luther was fighting with the Catholic Church. The last time the pope wasn't Italian until John Paul got elected in 1978.
Right.
So that's about 400 years or more of Italian only. So, yeah, they definitely have a leg up, and it was almost considered just basically, you know, in the early centuries, popes could be there from all over the place, Germany, France, Greece even.
Yeah, there was a few from Syria in the early church.
Oh, yeah. And then once we get to, you know, sort of early modern period, they're all Italian, and so many of the cardinals that elected the popes were Italian, and there was this whole cluster of high-ranking Italian churchmen that really kind of ran the Vatican bureaucracy and had a big say in who got to be the next pope. And this managed to get broken by John Paul II, and now twice now with Joseph Ratzinger or Benedict XVI. But no, that's definitely you have a leg up being Italian, particularly at that time in history. Now, you're talking about just being in that Italian context, and I think that's very, very interesting.
Yeah, set that up for us, because I think people know a lot about World War II, but you know, let's talk about Mussolini's Italy and the European scene and the interwar period. And again, we're talking the 1930s here. What's going on? And
well, you know, Italy was allied with Nazi Germany as we got into the 30s in this so-called Axis.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hitler and Mussolini were going to be allies during those critical events of the late 30s and into World War II. And the Pope sitting there in Italy. Now technically, he's in his own country, but you're surrounded by Italy. And that's definitely going to be a constraint on the Pope. And there's a couple of – I want to tell one story about this. When the U.S. was bombing Italy, at one point we asked the Pope to leave the lights on in Vatican City to help us find things. And the Vatican response was that, you know, well, no, we're not going to do that. That's like taking sides in a war. Also, the Vatican was against aerial bombings of any sort of civilian targets. And thirdly, they said, well, Mussolini can just cut off our power anyway. He controls the power grids. So there's nothing we can really do. You guys ought to know better than to ask us even to leave the lights on.
Yeah, that definitely is that consideration. As that Vatican City is how many square acres? It's not real big.
It's real small. Like a square mile or so. It's not very big. Like UW probably. It could fit in UW campus here if you count the Husky Stadium and all that area. Now, one of the things you have to keep in mind is, you know, the church had made an agreement with Mussolini, a so-called concordat, or they called the Lateran Accords, where they made peace with the Italian government, got their own little country, got special rights within Italy involving things like marriage law and education and whatnot. So there was a cooperation between the church and Mussolini, but also there were tensions. You know, Mussolini wanted to dominate everything. He wanted what he called totalitarian society. And this would come up against the church, particularly on things like who controls youth groups and those kinds of and certain, you know, aspects of education. So there was a tension there between Mussolini and the church. Now, you also got to keep in mind is the Vatican hires people to sweep the floors, wash the windows, lots and lots of just common Roman citizens are coming into the Vatican every day to do their daily jobs, like any institution. We have this same issue with our embassies around the world. You hire local people because they're cheap, they know the language, they know how to get things done. Well, in the Vatican, you've got to worry about, you know, who's infiltrating the Vatican.
Uh-huh.
Because all sorts of spies, you know, you never can trust what you're saying isn't going to get picked up by somebody somewhere.
And we've learned that recently, haven't we?
Oh, yeah, butlers, for sure.
Yeah.
So there's that sense of you know, people wonder, why doesn't the Pope leave a paper trail about certain policies? Well, you know, a lot of stuff they really don't want people to find out about because there's infiltration going on. So you're right in the middle of the Axis camp. But I think that can be really overstated because one of the important points I want to make is that the Catholic Church is a global church. It wasn't as global in 1940 as it is today, but it was still multinational. It wasn't just Italians. There were tons of Catholics all over Europe. There were Catholics on the Axis camp. There were Catholics in the Allied camp. So the Pope not only has to be careful about what Mussolini might do, but even if he was totally free and protected in Italy, things that he say could hurt Catholics in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if the Pope were to make some sort of inflammatory statement about Muslims tomorrow, that would jeopardize all Christians, not just Catholics, all Christians living in any Muslim country where they couldn't get adequate protection. So popes always have to be careful about what they're going to say because Catholics are living all over the world under all sorts of regimes, and anything that comes off as sounding provocative can create some sort of a backlash. So those are sort of constraints. So when Rome gets liberated by the Americans, Pope's policy does not change at all. He doesn't suddenly start criticizing Hitler more. He doesn't suddenly start piling on the Axis. He tries to remain impartial the way he had been through the entire war. Because that was a consistent policy based on things other than simply the fact that we're stuck here in Mussolini's Italy. So and one of the big Vatican ideas, and the same in World War I, was we want to remain impartial. Okay. Popes still try to do this in most wars of the 20th century. We want to be impartial because, first of all, we're supposed to be men of peace, not picking sides in wars. And secondly, we have Catholics living in all of these countries fighting against each other. We don't want to discredit the church in one country by siding with its enemies. There's lots of factors go into this. So the church tries to be impartial. That said, Pius was involved sort of indirectly in a plot to kidnap Hitler at one point.
Okay, well, let's hold on that for a second. Okay. I want to get to – so we just got the Pope elected. He seemed like the guy – he seemed like the guy for the job. He's got the diplomatic skills. He's Italian. He's also been to Germany. Things are shaken up in Europe at this time. So he definitely is the right guy for the job, being groomed, the whole thing. Now, his first year on the job is really going to be challenging because Hitler invades and partitions Poland with the Soviet Union, and that's a major Catholic nation, right? So that's going to be a big deal here. And it hands over a big chunk of this to Joseph Stalin, who was not known as being too friendly to religious organizations.
He was way worse than Hitler up to 1939.
Yeah.
He killed millions of people. Hitler just killed maybe 1,000. So it was, yeah.
So let's talk about this guy's on-the-job training. Again, he's got the diplomatic skills. He knows what's going on. But, whoa, 1939, that's a big year. So during this time, the invasion and the occupation of Poland, millions of Poles were rounded up in the prison camps and many executed there. And there was roughly 2,500 or 3,000 priests that were also executed during this time. And, again, not 1939, but could extend into 40, 41. To what extent did Pius XII have knowledge of what was going on there, and how did he respond to that situation?
Okay. Great question. Pius, he knows bad things are going on under both Nazi and Soviet occupation in Poland. He doesn't know the full scope of things. He doesn't know exactly everything that's going on, but certainly he's aware there are atrocities being committed and that the Catholic priests and other Catholics are being targets of these atrocities. In spite of that, the Pope does not come out publicly and say, look at what Hitler is doing to the Catholic priest in Poland. Now, there are a few reasons. And this, I think, is a very important piece of evidence because Pius's critics will sometimes say, well, Pius didn't speak out about the Holocaust publicly because he didn't like Jews. But we know that he didn't speak out even on behalf of Catholics in Poland. And so there's something else going on there. It's a much broader policy than just about Jews. This is the way Pius is going to talk about any sort of bad thing going on in Europe. Talk about it on the general level, not the specific level. So Pius said, horrible things have happened to Poland. They've been the victim of aggression. There are atrocities being committed. But he's not calling the Nazis to account on this. Same thing when the Benelux countries get invaded. He's like, you know, horrible things are happening. This is sad. But he's not saying this is unjust. This is wrong. Hitler should stop. Hitler should pull out. Now, this is sometimes surprising to people. The Catholic Church in Rome, the Vatican didn't get along all that well with Poland. You know, we think of, you know, because Poland's such a Catholic country and we've had this Catholic Pope for a quarter of a century that somehow the Vatican must just love Poland. But in fact, the Vatican position after World War I was that Poland was way too greedy, grabbed way too much territory, was creating the conditions that would lead to another world war by taking territory that Germany claimed as German and that was full of German citizens. So that was a problem. Poland's governments tended to be oftentimes anti-clerical during the 20s and 30s. So the church was oftentimes fighting with Polish governments. And then in 1939, when Hitler starts threatening Poland, the Vatican is pressuring Poland to give some things to Hitler. You know, we want to avoid a world war. And Germany has, you know, legitimate claims on some of your territory. You got more
Prussian
than you
territory.
Deserved. Yeah. The German territory, the stuff in the West, you know, the Polish corridor.
Okay.
And, you know,
okay.
Danzig and stuff like that Poland should be more accommodating to the Germans and thereby avoid a war. And it was a thinking that a lot of people felt is that the reason Germany wants a war is because they got screwed at the Peace of Versailles.
Yeah.
And so if you just let the Germans have some of this stuff back, they'll calm down. Maybe they'll even stop supporting Hitler and everything will get back to normal. So the Vatican wants to avoid war. You know, they always think about peace. They want to avoid war. And so then when the war breaks out and Poland's victim, the Vatican's sympathetic, but it's not going to come out and say, you know, get involved in sort of geopolitical arguments about who has a right to that land. They're really trying to stay above the fray at that point. So that was one of the the important thing to remember is that they're not speaking out specifically in condemning Germany, even when Germany is invading Catholic Poland.
So let me ask about this as well. And so you talk about Poland. What about the Holocaust? Because that comes up, and that's usually one of the big critiques of Pius XII, he's not speaking out about the Holocaust. Let me contextualize this a little bit as well. As to what extent did people outside of Germany know that this was going on? Because if I remember correctly, people have been very critical of the U.S. government for not standing out against the Holocaust and saying, well, you know, we didn't know what was going on, or if we knew what was going on, we didn't think it was as bad as what it really turned out to be. So in terms of the Holocaust, did the Vatican have some sense of what was going on?
Certainly some sense of what's going on. You know, I think just about everybody knew that Hitler's doing bad things
right. In
the territory, as was Stalin in the territories that they're occupying in the early years. So, you know, Holocaust technically starts in 42. That's when the Nazis actually sit down and say, we are going to systematically kill off all the Jews. But when they invade Poland in 39 already, they're rounding up Jews, they're shooting Jews. When they attack Soviet Union in 41, they're killing lots of Jews in fall of 41. A huge number, but not in death camp. They're just killing them and throwing them in pits. By the million, I mean, you know, millions. About half the Jews, I think, just got killed right outside their villages, shot through the head, not killed in camps. So there's a lot of just – and people knew bloody, horrible things were going, and reports kind of come through. So that's definitely an issue. But the church is always going to be – in fact, all countries will be the same way. You're always afraid that – okay, yeah, there's going to be atrocities during war. And bad things are going to happen, particularly countries like Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. But – to go from there to say, well, this is a systematic attempt to kill every Jew on earth, or, you know, every Jew in the Axis Empire, took a bit of a leap. Because, first of all, just that Hitler, when he's trying to win a war, would focus so much time, energy, attention, money, fuel, manpower, transportation, ammunition on exterminating an ethnic group that's really not that much of a – certainly not as much of a threat to him as, you know, the Soviet army or the allied air forces and things. It seemed a bit far-fetched. And then also there's the problem that during a war, your enemies try to – the one side tries to make the other side look bad.
Right.
So
right.
During World War I, we were taught that Germans were just grabbing babies and throwing them up in the air and catching them on their bayonets and all sorts of propaganda. And the first war in Iraq, I remember the supposedly Iraqi soldiers went into hospitals in Kuwait, were unplugging babies off of respirators and all sorts of – people make stuff up. So even if bad things are happening, there's always a sense of, is it really – this report I'm getting, is this really an accurate account of some guy that escaped from Auschwitz, or is this just some sort of Allied propaganda that's trying to get me to pick a side during the war? So there's always that kind of a hesitation. And the Vatican works slow anyway. I mean, it works. It's like a big lumbering elephant that doesn't turn corners really quickly, and they always want to think about things and rethink about things and on and on and on. So definitely they knew bad things were happening, but this was at such a scale, this was supposed to be a killing of all the Jews under Nazi occupation. And even the Nazi policy itself kind of adapts itself to situations. So when the Germans start to run out of manpower, they want the healthy Jews to be working, not dying. So even there you get the policies kind of shifting. So usually when I deal with this issue, I've taught a class on Pius XII, a seminar for history undergraduates for about 15 years now. And we talk a little bit about what did he know, but we generally operate in the assumption that he knew enough to know that bad stuff was happening.
Yeah.
So the idea that, well, we really didn't know isn't a defense. I think that the more important thing, if you're a defender of Pius, is to try to explain why, knowing that bad things are happening, you didn't publicly call the Nazis on this.
Mm-hmm. Now, you made a really good case for why that's not the case, that there's other Catholics in other countries, they're on different sides of the war, you could jeopardize their lives, the lives of the clergy in those places. There were reports coming out of Germany in World War II that there were a number of Catholics that were actually helping Jews during this period of time. So was there any underground activity directed by the Vatican? Did the Vatican know about some of this underground activity? How did they respond to this?
There was a lot of Catholics helped and hid more Jews than any other institution in Europe. I don't think there's anybody arguing. First of all, it's the biggest institution in Europe. There's no rivals. But if you look at all the political parties, labor unions, social groups, and on, the Catholic Church is really doing the most, either institutionally or just simply Catholics privately helping people. If you go to the Holocaust Memorial in Washington, D.C., they have the so-called righteous Gentiles. These are the lists of people that have been honored by Israel, by Yad Vashem, the Holocaust organization there, who've basically risked their lives to help Jews that needed rescued or hidden during the war. And if you go to the plaques for Poland, that's more names than anywhere. It's just tons and tons and tons. So a lot of people are getting help. There were people collaborating with Nazis, but there were also people helping either resist or helping with Jews. Now, we're Pius, and this is why in 1945 everybody was thanking Pius for being such a wonderful pope, because there's this perception, especially by non-Catholics, there's this perception that the pope is just runs the church. Everything any Catholic does must be because it's the Pope's command.
Right, right.
So if we're monks in a monastery and there's a Jewish family turns up at the door and we hide them in the basement for 5 years, people are going to think after the war, the Pope must have told the monks to hide the Jews. But as far as we know, Pope's not telling people to do anything, one way or the other. He's not saying, help Jews, don't help Jews. We have no written directives of Pope saying anything. There could have been oral directives. Some people claim they remember oral directives, but that didn't come out until the 60s when the controversy broke, so we're not really sure. But generally the Pope's view is, these decisions are made locally. So your bishop really is the guy that's supposed to decide what he's going to say, how he's going to deal with Axis occupation, whether he's going to side with resistance, whether he's going to collaborate, because basically the bishop's supposed to know the local situation. The Pope can't micromanage the church. The Pope can't decide whether, somebody in northern France or southern Italy or eastern Poland you can't have a one-size-fit-all policy for all of these areas, and you can't learn enough about them all. And the Pope, Mary, has an enormous amount of things to worry about. Japan has just conquered the Philippines. He's got to worry about how to keep the church in the Philippines operating on and on. So lots and lots. There's a lot of stuff on his table, and so a lot is left to the local bishops. They're really in charge. And so they're going to make these decisions. So, for example, in Assisi in Italy, the bishop, hid thousands of Jews, like pretended they were pilgrims coming to see St. Francis's tomb. In Venice, the bishop had no interest in helping Jews at all. He kept totally away from that issue. At the next level, you have monks and nuns. They're just, you know, somebody comes knocking on your door needing help. You make that decision yourselves. You don't call up the Vatican and say, gee, what should we do? You decide you're going to take somebody or you're not going to take somebody. So Catholic family, you know, if your Jewish neighbor needs help, you're not going to say, well, gee, did the Pope think I should help them? What's the Pope say? No, the Catholics don't think that way. You have your kind of religion, your morality, and you have all your own kind of likes and dislikes and prejudices from your own past, your relationships with people, and you make decisions based on that. So they can be informed by your faith, but it's not like, you know, the Pope is going to give you a directive. And the other, you know, I use this in my classes a lot with students. I'll say, you know, if you were Jewish and you were hiding with your family in some monastery, would you want the Pope to be publicly telling Catholics to hide Jews?
Yeah, probably not.
Or if you're just a Catholic family, would you want your bishop to be, you know, publicly saying we need to resist the Axis, we need to help the Jews, or do you want them just to keep their mouth shut and? Because this is an interesting point. It's one of the most important points I think one can make about this is as the war was going on and as all these church-state issues started to get into some kind of a modus vivendi, relating, there seems to have been sort of like a unwritten agreement. There are these lines that both sides didn't cross. So Hitler was somewhat constrained in how aggressively he would attack the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church was constrained in how aggressively it just wouldn't badmouth Hitler. When we get instances around Europe where some bishop, some Catholic leader says something against the Axis, there's usually some sort of a crackdown comes up. Then the Gestapo will start searching monasteries they left alone. And so there's this sense of like, you know, you don't mess with us, we won't mess with you. I was just the other – watched the movie The Godfather. And there's this scene, you know, that the gangsters do not want to shoot policemen because the cops will pretty much let them, you know, do their criminal activity. But if you kill a cop, they're going to crack down. And there was this sense that, you know, the Nazis will leave you alone for the most part. But if you start to mess with them, then they're going to mess back. And so there's a sense that if the church doesn't provoke the Nazis, particularly in a lot of the little allied countries like Slovakia and Italy, Austria. Well, Austria was already occupied, but you know, places like Italy and Slovakia and some of those places, the local Catholics could actually hide Jews, shelter Jews, and not get hounded out by the Gestapo. So in a sense, the Pope by laying low actually creates these sort of opportunities. Whereas if he was publicly affiliated as the great anti-Hitler figure, those opportunities might not be there.
Yeah, these pockets of safety, and I think that continues on too during the Cold War as well. Yeah,
and related to that is, you know, the fact that the Catholic Church is a religious institution. It's not a political organization. It's not a human rights lobby. It has all of those interests, but it's about, you know, getting people through this life on earth and ultimately into heaven by ministering to them spiritually, by providing the sacraments, by providing certain spiritual guidance, and also acts of charity. So feeding the poor, bringing medicine to the sick. And during the war, the Catholic Church did an enormous amount, as they did in World War I, of feeding the starving, rescuing famine victims, getting medicine to people that need it, getting food and medicine to POWs, helping people find their lost relatives. There were hundreds of thousands of people that were linked up through the Catholic Church. And like the International Red Cross, that prevents the dilemma because if you want to do those kinds of you know, global or international charitable operations, you cannot be seen as picking sides in a war. You have to be neutral. So the Red Cross had the same dilemma. They knew Holocaust was going on. They weren't going to publicly condemn it because Hitler could shut down their operations. And they felt that this is really what we're here to do.
Yeah.
Now, it'll become a scandal in later generations. One reason why Pius became a scandal in the 60s was, again, because of this play. But also that was the age when people rebelled against authority. And this attack on the Pope and on the Catholic Church was simultaneous with attacks on governments, on business, on military, on your parents. It was all part of that whole sort of 60s turbulence. And so in a certain sense, Pius gets swept up in that as well. But, you know, in the context of the time, you know, he looked like he was doing his job.
So you mentioned Yad Vashem before. Mm-hmm. In Washington, D.C., they have the plaques of the righteous Gentiles, and I've not been to the one in Israel. I assume they have something similar there as well. And again, at the end of June here in 2012, Yad Vashem changed their exhibit for the Vatican, for the exhibit with the portion of the Vatican and Pius XII in their museum in Israel, really softening the tone on this. And do you think there is this recognition that we're beyond the controversy of the 60s and into the 70s, and people are saying, you know, hey, look at the context of what was going on. Look at the role of the church. Look at all these different things that we just talked about. They were creating these pockets of security for Jews to hide in monasteries. And yeah, had he been more outspoken, that would have caused a lot more problems. Are they coming to that realization? Is this controversy subsiding?
It's hard to say. You know, first of all, the controversy, I said, broke out in the 60s. It was real turbulent for about 10 years. Then it was quiet. And then in 1998, a British Catholic named John Cornwell wrote a book called Hitler's Pope, where he claimed that Pius was the best pope possible for Hitler. And that created a whole new controversy and a whole new pile of books coming out on both sides. And only now is that sort of starting to die down a little. But it's hard to say with, you know, sometimes these fights between Catholics and Jews are connected with stuff going on in Middle Eastern politics. And the Catholic Church has never been as supportive of Israel as Jews would like it to be. You know, and Pope John Paul used to meet with Yasser Arafat and, you know, accept gifts from him and all sorts of things. And this would upset Jews. So sometimes there's a kind of a subtext of that. Like there's something going on. Or Israel needs some sort of, you know, wants Vatican support on some issue. And so I don't know. I don't know enough about those issues. But definitely that stuff sometimes goes on in the background. At the same time, I think that there's been, you know, the Catholic Church and Jews have had dialogue now for quite some time. And so these issues sort of come up. The big issue that has been an irritant is Vatican doesn't release all the documents for Pius XII. They work very slowly. The actual head of the Vatican Archive was actually in Seattle a few years ago, gave a talk at the Newman Center off campus, and he said, I don't disagree with him. I think he said, you know, they move very, very slowly. It's all disorganized. They don't have a lot of people working there. And what they do is the way the Vatican does it is they release the archive pope by pope. So they have to work through all the they got the Pius XI material from 1921 to 39. They've got to get all worked out, and then they move on to Pius XII, and then they move on to the next, you know, John the 23rd, and on. So that they work really slowly. But of course, the world wants these answers. At least, you know, then the academic world that's engaged in this issue, and so they would let teams of historians go in, but they still selected the documents that they were allowed to evaluate. Now, when new documents come up, they never really seem to shed much light on the issue. All they are is just versions of other things we already know. Like, well, the church did this in Switzerland. Now we have a document that said it did the same thing in Belgium. You know, so it's always everybody's working over the same material and using the exact same material. You can make Pius look like a saint or a criminal. It just depends on there are writers, for example, there's a critic of Pius that she never, ever, ever gives him the benefit of the doubt. And if you do that with any human being, they're going to end up looking bad in the end. And then the defenders are going to do the opposite, and they will give him always the benefit of the doubt. And so you end up with these, or the same documents will get interpreted in very different ways, or the cherry-picking where the defenders will pick certain documents. So if you defend Pius, you'll find the documents where the Nazis are saying, this guy is a disaster for us, he's working against us, he may not be speaking out publicly, but everybody knows who he really means. It's us when he says things negatively. And if you don't like Pius, you find documents where the Nazis are saying, we're so glad he's the Pope. Oh, he's letting us get away with murder. So it's all because, you know, you've got a huge country like Nazi Germany with thousands of bureaucrats producing all these reports in the military and intelligence and Nazi party and foreign policy. So you're always going to find reports saying just about anything you want to find. And so every possible way you can manipulate historical data, you can find in the Pius controversy, which is why I like to teach a course on it, because it's really kind of a course for students to see how history gets used and abused by partisans.
And I can also imagine, too, that if not all the documents are released, it just opens a big, huge cavern for conspiracy theorists to operate in.
So
I want to move on now. You've done a great job of kind of explaining what was going on during the wartime, but it's perhaps unfortunate that almost all the attention of Pius XII is spent on the wartime era. He remained pontiff for another decade and a half or so after the war, passing from the scene, I think, in 1958. What can you tell us about the post-war papacy of Pius XII?
Well, as I said, there's no controversy after the war with Pius. Everybody thinks he's a good guy. He takes a big interest in defending Germans from retribution after the war. So, you know, he didn't like Germans getting rounded up, sent to prison camps, Germans being expelled from countries where they'd been living for a while. He was he really was afraid of, and the Catholic Church has long been afraid of this, is they thought that the way Germany was treated after World War I was a disaster, and that created World War II. The Vatican was even saying in the early 20s that the Treaty of Versailles may actually make Soviet Union and Germany become allies, and we'll get another world war. So he wanted to, and that was also one of the reasons why Pius wanted to be impartial during the war, was to be a credible peacemaker after the war. That both sides, it didn't turn out that way. In fact, the U.S. turned out to be much more magnanimous than you could have imagined. You know, Germany starts two world wars, and we're still treating them pretty decently after the war. So the Pope's fears, I think, didn't really play out. But he definitely had this concern that Germany would get mistreated and Europe would have all of these tensions. Pius had a very interesting his last decade. He was, in a lot of ways, and this sometimes shocks Catholics, but he helped pave the way for the Second Vatican Council in certain ways. There were certain things about Pius that were, if not liberal, at least more in tune with the modern world. So, for example, he had a much more modern approach to biblical scholarship than a traditional Catholic would have. So he believed that when you read the Bible, you need to understand the literary genre. You need to realize that these are different. You know, these accounts are written for different reasons and different purposes. You don't treat them all as just a straight literal narrative. He believed in using archaeological evidence. He believed in it's important to know the historical context. A lot of times, you know, traditional Catholicism since the Middle Ages really didn't think a lot about the historical context of the Bible. It was really more about these revelations from God, and we can sort of construct our theology out of them, like building blocks. It was modern, you know, biblical scholarship says, you know, you really got to look into the context of the time and understand these things with at least not only that way, but taking that into account. So Pius pushes that. So he issues, you know, statements on, you know, promoting a more modern way of looking at the Bible. Another thing he does is he has liturgical reforms. He wants lay people to have a bigger role in the liturgy. You even start to get some masses in the native languages, not just Latin, under Pius, and just different changes in, you know, what you celebrate on what day, and in ways that are going to be more sort of user friendly, and that's you know, kind of the first rumblings of what's going to come in Vatican II. He had very sophisticated understanding of end of life issues, because, you know, medical technology is really taken off during his pontificate. So by the time, you know, by the mid-50s already, you know, people can be – you can be kept alive longer than maybe your body wants to stay alive. And even though there's sort of stereotype that Catholics believe you need to just fight against death and stay alive, you know, by all means necessary, Pius actually says no, that if you want to disconnect your, you know, respirator or whatever, that's perfectly legitimate, that there's no moral imperative to force yourself to stay alive when you're dying. Mm-hmm. But he said, but you might want to – in the sense, maybe you need to reconcile with people you've had problems with, or maybe you want to say goodbye to your loved ones. I mean, it's very nicely portrayed. So he has certain things that are going to sound, in a lot of ways, very modern. He was a big supporter of bringing more non-Italians and non-Europeans into the College of Cardinals. So he's helped foster a more global church. He's a big supporter of European unity. And it wasn't pious per se, but it was definitely Catholics who helped reconcile the French and the Germans. You know, people like Adenauer in Germany and Charles de Gaulle in France, they were Catholics from the Rhineland. They had a common culture. They were able to get along in the way other French and Germans couldn't. And Catholic Church really kind of lays foundation for European Union through those sorts of connections.
Let me ask you this, because one of the other things that you start to see happening during his post-war reign as Pope is the rise of the Iron Curtain. And, you know, the division of Germany and the Berlin airlift occurring during his papacy. And you see crackdowns in Czechoslovakia and, you know, Poland. Is he ringing any alarm bells by saying, whoa, this is all happening once again?
He is totally pro-American in the Cold War. I think this is the only time in history that the Vatican and the United States were so aligned. And so he's definitely, you know, this was Catholic Church was anti-communist. Pius XII was anti-communist. Even though he was anti-communist, though, he was willing to accommodate the Allies once the Soviets joined the Allied camp. So, for example, the American, American Catholics in particular, and a lot of Americans actually were leery about fighting in World War II on the Soviet Union's side. And one of the things that Roosevelt got the Pope to do was issue a statement to the American church that it's okay to support the Soviet Union because it's really supporting the Russian people. And so when the vote for Lend-Lease came up, that was an issue. And the Vatican said, it's okay. It's fine to vote for Lend-Lease. That's not somehow anti-Christian thing to do because it's isn't about Hitler attacking communism. Think about Hitler attacking Russia.
Russian people, yeah.
And so that was a few other. For example, Hitler wanted the Pope to declare a crusade against Soviet Union. And here we're fighting, you know, fighting. And remember, the church was already traumatized by the left because they were killing Catholics in Spain in horror. By 7,000 priests and nuns got massacred by the Spanish left in the start of the Spanish Civil War, and they were killing priests in Mexico.
Yep.
So the church was very afraid, and Stalin was killing huge numbers of all sorts of people, including Polish Catholics. Hundreds of thousands of Polish Catholics were killed in peacetime in Soviet Union before they even invaded Poland, just their own minority in the late 30s. So there was a sense. But in spite of all of that, the Pope still is willing to accommodate the Western allies in backing up. And one reason why he's not naming Hitler's name he's also not naming Stalin's name during the war. And the U.S. really – with the U.S., we wanted him to attack Hitler but not Stalin. And he says, I'm going to attack nobody by name. If you want me to attack Hitler, I'm going to attack Stalin too. And, of course, then that undercuts Allied Soviet relations. Once the Cold War comes, then, of course, you know, Soviet Union has the eastern half of Europe and they're cracking down on the Catholic Church and they're throwing bishops into internment camps and having show trials of priests and really constricting the Catholic Church. And Pope is totally supporting the exiled church. And that's going to – with John the 23rd, there's going to be more of a reconciliation with communists. And, of course, Stalin will be dead then too, so the communists will be sort of a little bit kinder and gentler.
Yeah, he's going détente, yeah. Right? Yeah.
But with Pius XII, it's definitely Cold War is on pretty much full force.
So let me finish up with this because we have a few more minutes.
Okay.
And one of the things that history teaches us is not only about the past but about how we understand ourselves in the present. And so if you have – as a person who's really looked at this in your undergraduate classes, you've studied this, so you're very close to this, what kind of legacy, what kind of lessons can we draw from the papacy of Pius XII for our understanding of the world today or perhaps the papacy of Benedict the XVI?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about this and one of the lessons I think is 1939 was too late to really worry about trying to stop Hitler. Mm-hmm. That you really should have been taking a tougher line against Hitler in like 1932, 33. And Catholic Church started out pretty tough against Hitler and then they sort of started backing off. And of course we didn't know how bad he was in 33. We didn't even know how bad he was in 39. But there was enough there. I think that looking at Nazism from a Christian perspective, and particularly from Catholic perspective, because Catholic Church has done a lot of thinking about political systems and how they're, you know, what's a just versus an unjust system. There was enough data there on the Nazis, just in terms of what they say, let alone what they do, that should have raised a lot of red flags. And they should have probably been treated the way communists would have been treated, like a real danger that you really can't work with in any sort of a serious way. And that didn't happen. The church was more accommodating because there was a sense, you know, the Nazis weren't anti-Christian specifically. They supported, you know, they had pagans, they had Protestants, they had Catholics. They were kind of a multi-religious group, and they were hoping to Hitler did not want to antagonize churches needlessly. When he needed to, he'd antagonize them a lot, but he didn't want to go out of his way. You know, when the Bavarian people wanted crucifixes on the walls and the Nazis took them down, Hitler said, you know, put them back up. We're just pissing off a lot of Bavarians, mm-hmm. and that's going to make it just harder to run Germany and win the war. So he was, in a lot of ways, for all his wild idealism, Hitler was pragmatic on a lot of these religious issues. But I think the lesson was, you know, that really look at these, when these movements start to emerge, you know, really look at these movements and what do they really stand for, and what's their real ideology, and to be able to discern, is it all just talk, or are they really as you know, as sick as they sound?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the church could have done a better job with that. It could have been more vigilant in that embryonic phase of Nazism, and then it was just starting to grow before it's in power. Once it's in power, you really just have to accommodate it in some way to try to survive. But it's those early years when you could, you know, maybe take a stand and provoke a crisis that maybe could push history in a little bit different or even a much different direction. So I think that's one of the lessons. I think another lesson just is about human – just the way we are as human beings. I think, you know, we really want to be in control of things. And I think when something really bad happens, we always like to say, well, gee, if we just had better gun control laws, that guy at Cafe Racer in Seattle mm-hmm. wouldn't have got shot those people. Or if we just had more money for mental health interventions, this wouldn't happen. And a lot of times there's a certain, you know, there's a certain truth to that. You know, if you anticipate problems and have better policies and better funding, you can avoid. But some problems you're just not going to avoid. There's just bad things are going to happen. There's bad people out there. There are political movements that can mask their intent. There's all kinds of ways. And I think by trying to focus on, well, if only Pius had spoken out, you know, or just if only the British and French had, you know, got backbones and stood up to Hitler at Munich, and yeah, but you know, they didn't, and there are reasons about the context of the time why they didn't, and I think that's one of those. It's kind of humbling to think that, you know, we really can't control all the events in mm-hmm. the world, and bad things are really going to happen. And then also there's, I think, a human propensity to blame. Like we want to blame somebody when something goes bad. You just kind of say, well, it happened. And it's funny that we don't blame Hitler. You know, people blame Pius.
Right.
As the sub. I guess because Hitler's beyond redemption. But
right.
At least you could think, well, Pius could have done it differently. But like I said, you know, could he have really done anything by speaking out? And that whole – because it comes up again and again, you know, when do you speak out and when do you hold your tongue for the sake? And I think a lot of times I think Pius had a sober assessment of the reality of the time.
Yeah. No, it actually reminds me of our discussion as we were talking about is the contemporary situation with the Catholic Church in China. That you know, similar difficulties being faced by the church, and you know, when do you speak out? Why shouldn't the Vatican be speaking out more? Well, because, you know, that could antagonize the situation and make it worse than it does.
Yeah, so they get a lot of responsibilities on the shoulders as the Pope. And we have these kind of, I think, as humans, we have these like resistance fantasies. Like we just wish, you know, if I was in Nazi Germany, I would have joined the resistance. And I always tell myself, well, how would you have found them? Would be my first question. Like you go, you know, you get the Yellow Pages, or I guess they have phone apps now. You can just find the resistance and then you join. I would have hid Jews in my house. Well, if a stranger comes up on your door, how do you know that's not a provocateur of the regime?
Yeah.
That's knocking on your door and on and on. It's you know, reality gets very, very complex. But you know, we do say, and this is where the saints come in, and I don't mean just the officially canonized Catholic saints, but I mean people, you know, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Corrie ten Boom, and there are a whole number of Franz Jagerstatter, the Catholic who refused to get drafted into the German army, and on and on. And they do. There are people that really do rise to the occasion. Those are like the prophets in our society. And popes generally aren't prophets. I mean, they have responsibility for running a whole – it's like, you know, you have your prophets and you have your people that are actually in responsible positions. And the two don't always go – oftentimes don't go together. And so the Pope's job is to get the church through the Second World War and, you know, minimize the injustice and the horrors of the time. And it's up to other people to make that stand and give their lives even to speak out. And people did that.
James, I want to thank you again for being on Research on Religion. We'll keep tabs with you, and when you finish that book on Pope John Paul II, we'll get you back on.
Great. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.